Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-host.
Cardamandua. I'm too young for this.
There we
go. We had to get her to say it while she was here.
That was all a setup for you, Anna Lee. Good job. You just...
set up, huh?
Welcome to episode 132. I'm Dan Q. Didn't your mother teach you never to leave your weak defenders out in the open? Joined by the Mean Team.
Killing spree? No. I went domination.
Lisa, Q&L.
Hello.
The Anna Lee Cartamandua.
You know you missed me.
And one, Mackie.
First topic is a thread started by Penny, and it's a release of a multiplayer mod titled Beyond the Game 1.00. So it's a major release of a mod. For Civilization 4, this is basically it functions as an executable file that you can run that really changes multiplayer gameplay significantly. And there are a lot of changes. We could probably spend the entire episode on this topic if we wanted to do that, but we're not going to do that. So it's going to be a little bit much to read off, but basically you can change the turn timer, you can change the rules, like blocking people from building spies. You know, you have a lot of multiplayer policing options, like reporting players for bad behavior and such in there. There's, let's see, you even have like more esoteric things, like removing the tech discounts for prerequisites, or banning corporations, for example, or banning blockades, which I think is ridiculous, but the option's there. And it also disables quite a few other things, or enables them as the player chooses. So basically, it gives Civ 4 multiplayer a lot more options based on what the competitors want. And it's really just an issue then of whether competitors pick the options that are best, but nevertheless, the options are there, and this mod looks very impressive. It also does some minor patches, like overflow patching, because Beyond the Sword 3.19 was incompetently bugged by Firaxis, and that it introduced the overflow bug that late in the game cycle. So that's there. I would be really interested to see if this fixes the controls. I'm almost excited to try it just for that, so we'll see.
Well, I think that it's good that they did release something to, you know, address some of the issues that people have been reporting. I mean, it's kind of sad that it's not Firaxis doing it. But at the same time, you do need a stable environment for multiplayer Civ, especially since the games are so long and people... I mean, it's just... It's a lot for a server to handle, I feel. And if it's not... Well, I don't know. The way it stands now without this mod, it's just not going to work. So... it's interesting that Civ Players has made this mod mandatory for anybody that wants to play, like, big, you know, large, like, regular lobby games, but, at the same time, like, I don't see the huge difference between that and Civ Fanatics Hall of Fame, you know, requiring that you use a Hall of Fame mod to submit games. That said, it's come out so recently that I don't think any of us have had time to really play it that well, that much. But from what it says, I mean, it fixes the Oracle bug, it fixes the liberalism bug, it fixes the production gold overflow bug that came in 3.19, and they're trying to do an option where they're broadcasting games live through the replayer status, so people can join as an observer of a game, of a multiplayer game, and can passively look at the game without playing it, and eventually they can, you know, broadcast the game. But as of now, this feature is not implemented, so when it does come out, I think it'll be pretty exciting. If it works, that's the important caveat here.
Yes. The comparison to the Hall of Fame mod, Buffy, is very interesting because essentially that's a pretty good analogy. Buffy being more for single-player games, whereas this would be for multiplayer. And it does add a layer of, authenticity in that it's much more difficult to cheat with this in play than it would be without it. Also interesting just to have the gold lever flow back. I wonder if they restored 3.17 levels or if they just made it like the fan patch for 3.17 where you no longer get the multiplayers on walls and such. A lot of people liked Protective back in the day because you could chop and whip a wall into a city and get a couple hundred gold for it. I'm not sure I'd like that back in multiplayer per se, but it is good that you can actually get some gold from Overflow again.
It is good that you can do that. There's a couple other changes that I'm not sure I agree with. Like, for example, they tripled the probability of your encountering, you know, something in a mine, be it iron, gold, or gems, or whatever else you can get in a mine. And they justified this by saying that they wanted to tip the balance towards more hilly land. But at the same time, like, hills are one of the stronger tiles you can work until you get, you know, workshops or your cottages grow up or whatever. But I don't know if that was actually really necessary, that part.
Yeah, that's kind of strange, to be honest. I mean, that it's a fairly rare event, even with three times the regular pace. And what is it, like a 1 in 1,000 chance in the base game per turn, per mine work or something? Or maybe it's more, maybe it's 1 in 10,000. It's a fairly rare event. I don't get it. I don't get the needs of balance towards heavily held land. I don't know. I don't see that. If you get all flat land, you're kind of screwed. It's like Lisa says, maybe they over-rely on cottages and financial. I don't know. That's a really strange one in my eyes.
Beyond the Game, of course, take off on Beyond the Sword. It's a standalone executable, a 1.5 gigabyte download. But once you have it downloaded, it is essentially, again, a replacement for the Beyond the Sword executable that includes the entire Beyond the Sword game minus the videos. There is three additional game speeds that are added. There are a couple of extra victory types, and particularly with a one-city challenge focus, there's a one-city challenge focus option. Focus for that, I talked about the removal of no corporations. There's the elimination of a technology discount, and also the ability to research multiple technologies on the same turn. So it gives some additional flavor options to the game. And as was pointed out, you know, this mod was just released. It doesn't really get into how much internal testing was done. Acknowledge that there will be future revisions for bug patches, and hey, there are additional features that they want to incorporate. Some other balance options, disabling circumnavigation, which I kind of like, but I like can cross ocean. Removing the restriction of a boat that cannot cross ocean. I actually liked the option, and I think it was in Civ 1 and Civ 2 where there was the possibility, I mean, it was pretty random that if you took a galley out into the ocean, it may or may not be lost in the open waters on the turn rollover. Although it's not so much of an issue in multiplayer because it would be kind of difficult to do, but in single player, I loved, you know, like saving the game right before I did that and then reloading because it was... From the balance and scenario options, I kind of gave a little smirk to that you can get a free scout start where scouts can be built without any technology, so you no longer need the hunting tech. But I love the disabling of the great work. Remove the ability for the great artist to bomb culturally. Justification was that it was considered as inconvenient because it reinforced defensive behaviors too much. But again, it's an option, so it's not like if you get beyond the game, if you want to participate in this, then you have to follow these. But they've kind of added these from a standardized interface, again, from a separate executable. So what this means, of course, is it's not like, oh, you want to back up your Beyond the Sword executable, and then if you want to go back and play quote-unquote standard Beyond the Sword that you'd have to replace the file. It's a separate file, a separate executable, and it gives instructions of where to install it, so it would appear. you know, in that folder, and you could create a shortcut to it, and then swap how you wanted to go back and forth.
Are games compatible? Like, if you generate a single player save under Beyond the Game, can you run it in standard Beyond the Sword 3.19 and vice versa?
From the documentation I have seen, that question is not addressed. It could just simply be because this has been a multiplayer focus and they haven't really looked at that possibility. So it's probably reasonable to assume that it is not.
Yeah.
Like, to me, if you're advertising a mod, compatibility is something that you would want to promote, because then it's, hey, it's not like you have to make a choice between one or the other. It's an option. So since they don't talk about that, I'm going to assume that, in fact, that's not compatible. Right now, anyway. I mean, this is version 1.00. This is the first full release of this mod. So it's reasonable that this is not going to be the beginning and the end of this mod's life, public life.
Well, I mean, they do mention that all files are merged with game files. I'm not sure how I feel about this being mandatory for Civ players, multiplayer, but, you know, I think that it does definitely add something new to the game at a time when, you know, you kind of thought that Civ 4 stopped changing because, you know, there's Civ 5 out now. But I don't know, I think this is a good indication that, you know, the Civ 4 community is still, you know, very active. And Civ 4 is still a dynamic game. People are still releasing mods for it. I don't know, I think it'll just be interesting to try out at the very least.
And indeed, because they're making it, even though it's required for Civ player play, it doesn't mean that it is only for Civ player play.
Somebody had a lot of time and expertise with Excel. Good for him. And also good for us, because if you really feel like the Civ 4 combat calculator is probably not that great, and you really feel so strongly about it to the point where you have to download this Excel spreadsheet, switch, you know, programs, enter the relevant information in the Excel spreadsheet to get the real victory chances, then yes, you might want, this might be for you. So it takes, actually it is kind of cool, albeit like really dirty. It's kind of like, I don't know what it's like. It's kind of like pocket protectors, you know, like you don't really want to be seen with one, but they are useful. So,
dirt like pocket protector.
Really, you don't want to be seen with the slide rule either.
Why do you have to make fun of Dan that way? Come on,
with his pocket protector and slide rule,
his abacus.
So this was actually started by Sarah. Okay, I'm just gonna spell it Sarelln. And if you download the spreadsheet, you can actually put in, you know, up to 11 attackers and up to 11 defenders, put in their base strengths. I don't know what this element, you know, independent modifiers, dependent modifiers, first strike chance, and initial HP. You can also put in the retreat chances. Now, what would really be useful is, like, if you had something that auto-filled it for whatever kind of unit you had, and then you could just, you know, modify, you know, the initial HP or, you know, whatever upgrades you had. But this is pretty good, too, if you want to spend the time typing in the numbers. And the most important part, it's presumably more accurate than the in-game combat calculator. I mean, I've heard some complaints about, you know, oh, I lost, you know, 299.9% games in a row. And the chances of that are like 1 in a million, like literally 1 in a million. So, you know, either some people are really that, you know, that person that's 1 in a million, or there's something wrong with the in-game combat calculator. So yeah, if you're tired of like losing 299.9% games in a row and, you know, you're willing to put those numbers in, then you can find out that your chances are really like 99% or something.
You're shortchanging this a little bit, I feel, because there's something that this does that you cannot get in game, and that's to get your odds using a number of attackers against one defender. Basically, say you have a situation where you have 3 chariots against 1 hill archer, and you want to know, okay, what are my chances of winning attacking that archer on a hill in that city with these 3 chariots? And this would be able to tell you that. And it probably wouldn't be that hard to enter. A little bit of copy-paste action, perhaps, and a little bit of alt-tab between this and the game. And you could probably do it inside of 10 to 20 seconds if you are really playing a game where that outcome matters to you. Be that a play by email, maybe a Hall of Fame game that's, you know, close, something like that. I could find something like this potentially very useful. But no, you won't see me alt-tabbing to this on YouTube, probably. Probably. I make no promises. I know better than to make promises.
And even though it isn't an Excel spreadsheet, you can use other software to open this file and modify it. Like, for example, I used OpenOffice to be able to run it. Just know that given the nature of this spreadsheet, it does use macros, so you will need to modify your security settings in order to enable macros, so that will actually work.
Well, I would have liked to see what this spreadsheet would be like without macros. I mean, this is something that you kind of need that for. I mean, I guess if he really wanted to be nerdy, like, he could just go into, you know, Access and then have that reference, like, well, I mean, I don't know how this problem could work. Because, I mean, you could actually just, like, enter in, like, you know, whatever unit it is. I mean, there's only, like, 30 units, right? And then have it reference another, you know, table that, you know, lists all the specificities of, you know, the different...
You don't need macros for this. Come on, now.
I mean, you don't need
to enter in units. You just enter... You're entering their base strength and the modifiers for them. So
yeah,
you don't need that. The only thing you're using macros here are probably these, like, calculate odds and clear table buttons and that kind of thing. Because otherwise, you would just enter in the stuff and you'd be able to see the outcomes right away. Just with straight formula and formula linkage.
I
use a lot of Excel, too,
language, but
so
I would
you do not need macros.
I would rather do it with Access, but, you know, I mean, that's just me. I mean, it kind of drives me crazy that you have to, yeah, because, I mean, why would you have to enter in the base? I mean, okay, like, there are some units for which you know the base strength already, I mean, especially the beginner ones, but, like, I mean, unless you've played Civ as much as, like, we have, like, you know, you're not going to know.
It's
right
going to be using this
I
don't think you could tell me a unit where I wouldn't know its base strength. And I think that's true for a lot of people who would be using this chart.
I don't know. I guess that's true. Especially if you're alt-tabbing it. But I don't know. I mean, for me, it kind of breaks the flow of the game. I mean, I can see how it could be useful, but I probably wouldn't.
This is why you play in windowed mode.
Yeah. So, Mackie, you're saying that you're going to use this combat calculator every time you go into combat?
No. The solution is just build more units, throw the stack at everything, done.
You have to calculate your odds of your 10 rifles beating the 2 longbows in that city just to be safe. Make sure you spend 30 seconds doing it.
Unless your turn time is ridiculously long or there isn't a turn timer, this probably isn't going to help you very much in multiplayer. But on the macro thing, in addition to the clear table button, to calculate the odds, it actually is a button. It's not just, it doesn't look like you can just enter the number. Like, I tried entering the number and the percentages didn't change. The way it's set up, I actually hit the calculate odds button, which looks like that also is attached to macros. But I could see how you could change how that this is set up. Not that I'm going to do it, mind you, so that you wouldn't actually have to do that.
I don't know. I mean, but it makes me think that if this kind of thing, this BTS traffic calculator can be encompassed so easily in an Excel spreadsheet, then what the heck is wrong with, like, you know, why is it that the existing, you know, combat calculator in the game can be off like this? I mean, it doesn't really seem like hard calculations, you know?
It almost never is off in game, actually. But what happens is people just get unlucky outcomes and they don't like it and they complain about it when there really was like a 1 in 100 chance or a 1 in 1,000 chance that it happened. But you fight a couple hundred battles per game in a lot of games. So getting something that's 1 in 100 or even 1 in 1,000 isn't that unexpected. But yeah, people have run the Civ random number generator for like thousands or tens of thousands of iterations and gotten nothing unusual in terms of the actual count of random number generator outcomes. It was always right around the expected values. When taken across many things, I'm not really familiar with how random number generators work, but I haven't even seen much evidence of that, to be honest. There's a lot of things wrong with the game, but I don't think the RNG is actually one of them.
On to, well, actually, it's still more on math, but maybe not quite so scary math. On civ demographics, specifically Civilization 5, but I think we're going to inevitably talk about Civilization 4 demographics again, which we did discuss almost 3 years ago, November 2008. We talked about Civ 4's demographic screen. Well, this is about Civilization 5 from Pyrate, past podcast guest, actually. I'd like that quote. I'd like to know what all the numbers in the demographic screen mean, since the game doesn't give a lot of info on how you compare to the other nations. So here's what's available. You got population, crop yield, production, GMP, land, soldiers, approval, and literacy. And there are some of these that are given further discussion and others not. So why don't we just start with the ones that probably isn't a lot to say. Crop yield, the sum of all food production in your empire, not food surplus. Production, the sum of how much each of your cities is currently producing, and your GMP, that's your total income, but again, not profit. And land, the number of land tiles within your border times 10,000. And the crop yield, production, and GMP is measured in millions as the unit of measurement. You actually have to hover over in Civ 5 to get that information, whereas that's on screen in Civilization 4. Took me a while to realize, what is this unit of measurement? Oh, I just have to hover over it. Okay. But the ones that got some discussion in this thread and a couple of related threads on another forum was population, soldiers, approval, and literacy.
Those are interesting. Yeah. They weren't very useful in Civ 4. Well, there was no literacy rating in Civ 4. You had, like, health or something, and it was a straight ratio of how much happiness versus unhappiness you had, well, other way around. Anyway, this is interesting, and I'll be keeping my eye to see how well the demographic analysis develops in Civ 5, because it's gotten really deep in Civilization 4, to the point where a lot of people have suggested banning it. Of course, ban everything in multiplayer, right? But there is... It's a very powerful tool. If you watch the demographic screens from turn to turn, you can tell what technologies people have researched. You can tell you can tell what tiles they're working, what kinds of tiles. So you can tell what units they're training based on a combination of changes in power and changes in population, for example. Like if a city doesn't grow, you know they're building a worker or settler. And if you put all these things together and carefully watch it, you can basically see what everyone's doing from the start of the game, especially in sequential turn games, which is kind of silly. At the same time, though, it's a useful tool and it's part of the game. But what we don't have on this thread is, you know, okay, how much power is each individual unit worth in the game? Or exactly how GNP is calculated. Is there a bias or anything? It looks like it's just a straight measurement of your output, but does that include culture and yada yada? I don't think so, but it's just it certainly included culture and Beyond the Sword, which is strange to me, and it makes it harder to use the GNP figure. You see some massive GNPs, and a lot of it's just wonder-mongering because of the culture it provides. But nevertheless, a demographic screen can be very useful, more so in multiplayer than single player, because AIs tend to follow patterns of one kind or another. Plus, they start out with massive bonuses anyway and fail on trades and tactical issues, which makes the demographics less useful in single player. But in multiplayer, the ability to basically know exactly what your opposition is doing without scouting them from the start of the game is fairly huge. So people who learn the demographics are going to have an advantage for certain.
With Civ 5's demographics, indeed, there hasn't been as much in-depth discussion anyway. Maybe there has been the exploration, it just hasn't been the discussion and the general sharing of the knowledge in Civ forums. I'm going to mention soldiers specifically, because Phil just mentioned that as one of those, you know, to try to delve a little deeper into it, where this thread on Civ Fanatics is looking at all demographics in general terms and looking to get more information. There was a specific thread on soldiers' demographics on 2K, where military score is dependent on unit type, unit promotions, unit number, and the amount of gold a civilization has, whereas a military score is not dependent on your cities you have, the power of the city, the unit combat power, technology score, or the turn number, where unit type is a unit base power, determines the first unit's score, which is a positive, modified by unit promotions and current Civ gold. And there are examples in that thread in terms of a unit type with and without promotions, and then how many units you have of that particular type of unit, then translating into what the demographic screen will report. And hello, goodbye, 123, who was a recent guest on RevCast, says, why are you guys making a formula? Now people are going to figure out all I have is two Jaguars in 1500 AD. So, again, you really start looking at some of this data, and, you know, if this actually pans out, then, like you said, if you're watching it from turn to turn, you can get a better idea of what's going on with other civilizations in the world, even if you haven't met them yet.
Well, I mean, I don't know if how much I love this whole literacy thing, because I've taken a look at it for in-game, and from what it says in the thread, it's actually based on, you know, the number of texts after writing available the number of texts you have after writing that you have divided by the number of texts that are available after writing. So it's just a straight up, like, you know, it straight up increases every time you get a text. But, I mean, it doesn't really take into effect your beakers per churn or, you know, how you're, I mean, I don't know. I would like it if that metric were in some way, you know, more related to how other civs were doing, just because definitions of literacy, you know, evolve, as, you know, other civs also evolved. You know, in the beginning, it could have just been considered, you know, knowing how to read. But now it could just be like, you know, knowing how to read at, you know, some level. So, I don't really understand why you would call it literacy if it's just, if you're just taking into account the number of texts that people have after a certain one. Like,
yeah,
after you learn how to write.
Calculation would need to be in there somehow.
Yeah,
you can have a lot of text, but you can have a lot of stupid people. I mean,
I would like it to somehow be linked to, like, you know, how many beakers, you know, each city was generating relative to what it could be generating, or what kinds of specialists you're running, that sort of thing. Yeah, this metric doesn't really seem like the most useful. It just means, you know, how many texts you have. I mean, why don't you just call it, you know, I don't know, technological advancement index or something, rather than literacy.
Yeah, I mean, strictly speaking, like in the quote-unquote real world, literacy to me is not only the ability to read, but to be able to understand what it is that you are reading. And if I recall correctly from Civ 4 demographics, literacy takes into, I don't know to what degree it takes into account the technology tree itself in terms of what text you've reached, but it takes into account your beaker count, which of course then can get into, oh, like my literacy rate is very poor, but if I build more libraries, for example, or universities, then that's going to increase the likelihood that a greater percentage of my population is going to be literate, and a greater percentage of the population is going to not just be able to read, but to, you know, understand what it is that they're reading, and then to use that knowledge to get further technologies as well. So it does seem to be, now in Civ 5, as you said, Lisa, just a percentage of the technology tree you have researched after writing seems to be a very simple measure, and depending upon how you know think about the word literacy, you could get a skewed perspective, you know, in terms of what's going on there. But I mean, I really don't actually pay that much attention to that literacy percentage anyway, although perhaps I should, and perhaps I would pay attention to it more if it in fact took more factors into account, because it, you know, it was interesting, but it really wasn't as important as some of the other demographics that are listed.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could be okay if you were trying to figure out, like, how technologically advanced another civ was, or, you know, just figure out that you're not the most technologically advanced civ around. I don't know. I mean, there's also the population metric. There's a formula for it. It's kind of weird. 1,000 times P, where the P is the number of citizens, to the 2.8, which I don't know why they chose 2.8. Maybe it's because it's close to, you know, the natural number E. I don't know. The point is that it's exponential. So, you know, it's much easier to get from, you know, 1 to 2 citizens, than it is to get from, you know, 3 to 4, for example, or even 19 to 20. And, you know, once you go from, you know, 19 to 20 citizens, the difference between steps 19 and 20 is greater than, or citizens 19 and 20 is greater than the difference between cities 1 and 2, which basically means that, you know, if you're really going for a population, you want to, you want to try to, you know, build your cities vertically. Have fewer larger cities rather than many small ones. If you want to be number one in the demographics for population, that is. That's your goal.
You want number one population? Carpet your landscape with farm.
Yeah, well, that helps too. It helps in score too.
Yeah, it does. So if you're going for a time victory.
Or you're playing a co-op multiplayer game where you decide who did the best based on the score.
I've never heard of this. That's my AI. Time to turn all my cottages into farms. Milk the score.
No, we wouldn't know anything about the man team farming over his town's late game and hitting the emphasized food button. Oh, no.
No, not at all.
Happen.
He's been behind all game. Suddenly he's at the top of the scoreboard.
And the only other demographic that's discussed in any particular detail, and this is the one that's discussed the least, Nunez says that he thinks he sees a pattern. Approval rate, of course we know it was based on happiness, but approval rate seems to be 60% plus the multiplied value, I almost said multiplicated, the multiplied value, and I said it anyway, the multiplied value of 3% times your net happiness.
Wait a second. 0.33% times your native happiness?
Your net happiness.
Net happiness.
Oh, this is how you go below 60 if you're negative happy.
I guess. I mean, why put that benchmark at 60%? I mean, they just want you to be... I mean, why not at 50, you know? Yeah, I mean, you know, you have more time... You have more to go, you know, up than down, I guess. Dude, could you be negative?
Really an important
happiness?
Anyway.
That would be really funny. I mean, if you had, like, more than 20, you know, unhappy citizens, net unhappy citizens,
sure
then you could be negative happy, which
train,
I don't
like,
even know what that means.
Train, like, 30 settlers on a game, and don't settle them until, like, train them all before settling them, and then settle them all at once. And I'm sure you could completely tank your happiness.
I really want to see what would happen if I could get negative happiness.
You mean getting negative on unhappiness for negative happy citizens? You're talking about negative approval.
Sorry, I mean negative approval.
Negative,
yeah.
Okay.
Based on the formula, you can too. Because if you have 3% times a negative number, then you're going to get 60% plus negative something greater than 60%. You should be able to get a negative value. Although the game might just display zero in that case. I'm not sure.
I mean, conceivably, it could be easier to get, you know, more than 100%. I mean, because, you know, you only have to get, I don't know, like, you know, 14 happy citizens, net happy citizens to get over 100. This would be really cute. I want somebody to do it and post a screenshot. I might even do it myself because, I don't know, I find it funny.
Approval rating, over 9,000.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it'll top and bottom at 100%. I can't promise that, but considering I've been over 14 happiness or even over 20 happiness, and I haven't seen over 100% approval rate, I'm thinking they cap it.
Aww.
But I could be wrong. I don't think so, though.
Well, let's give people an incentive to actually do this other than our just saying so. If you do so and you inform us that you've tested this, Pixar doesn't count, then what you need to do is inform us. We'll mention your username on the show and Lisa will send you a virtual kiss.
No.
But those virtual kisses.
I love how you're just like giving them away without my consent, man. I charge a lot for these things.
What is not listed on Civ 5 demographics, but is on Civ 4, is Civ 4 also talked about life expectancy and imports-exports. Now, life expectancy, of course, was a health-based measure, so I guess I can see why they didn't think to necessarily include it. And as for imports-exports, that thing was so... I don't miss it.
Civ 4 didn't have imports-exports. Civ 5 doesn't either, but at least in Civ 5, there's no reason to have it. Because you don't have foreign trade routes, so it doesn't matter. But it's better than that buggy disgrace that was the imports-exports value that showed up for Civ 4 on the demographic screen. You couldn't glean anything from that. It was worthless.
Now, there was a value that was could be often negative.
Yeah.
It's like, what?
Intended to be negative if you were doing well.
With regards to the demographics, that information, you could also start comparing with other civilizations you met through... graphs through, once we got to Beyond the Sword and espionage, having a certain amount of espionage, and you'd be able to see how you were doing even more so relative to everybody else, because like in Civ 4, Civ 5 shows you the worst, and will also tell you your rank. Wait a minute here. Yes, the average and the worst on there. And when it talks about, like, the average, like, maybe it's just me, but especially since you don't have that graph to be comparing everyone, I mean, average can be really skewed. I would prefer a median, actually. That would apply to Civ 4, too, but perhaps that's just me.
No, I like the average, because you can infer a lot from the average that you probably couldn't from a median value. Specifically, you can get a decent picture of what other people on the ranges are doing by using the average plus other criteria. I don't know how much detail I can get onto it on the show here, but I got to tell you, in these multiplayer games that are not fast turn timers, like the stuff I'm doing in Realms Beyond, you see some amazing stuff through demographic analysis. And just amazing. I wasn't kidding when I said earlier that pretty much people know what everyone else is doing at all times in the early game. Like what tech they chose to pick, what whether they chose to build a worker versus a warrior and or scout. When they expand, they know that right away. It's crazy. Or how many pop they grew their city to before building their second worker. They know all this. And because of the averages and the starting techs and the starting situations for all the players, they can usually tell for everybody, and the average is a function that matters for that. Now, you could argue that that's a bad thing and that you'd use median values because knowing all that is not as good. And I could see that. I wouldn't have a problem with median, but in terms of use, the average is probably more useful because you can get a better picture.
I guess it was just where you're having the extremes where someone is doing really well or really badly, then the average is going to end up being skewed. But yeah, at the same time, I guess, yeah, I can also see how that could also be positive for you. So maybe if we actually had both, there we go, rather than it being a substitution, just have both to help put it all into greater context. Especially now in Civ 5 with the absence of, having a graph where we can go, ooh, here's how it is relative to everybody else.
Yeah, if you look on the Civ 5 graph and you see that you think you have a large army, but then the average amount of soldiers is bigger than your army, you know you're in trouble. Same thing for GMP and things like that.
Set up by Marigold Ran, entitled The Alphabet Trick. Now, he or she, I don't know, argues that they have this trick that they do where they rush for alphabet, pretty much skipping what they determine non-essential text, going straight for alphabet, and then back-trading all the other texts. Now, because of that, he ends up not building workers, but building a lot of warriors or settlers or whatever. However, he doesn't get a lot of support from the rest of the commenters on this poll, I don't think. Wow, Dan.
I'm in your brains.
Anyway, I think it's really difficult to see the logic behind this. It's putting a lot of, it sounds very complicated way to get even the small advantage, which I'm not even sure he's going to get. Let's see, argues that you're saving hundreds, perhaps thousands of research points by skipping these other texts and going straight for the alphabet, which allows you to get currency and mathematics earlier, which allows you to have better trade, text to trade later on. But this, I don't know, it just seems really like he's cutting himself short here. I have to agree with a lot of the other commenters that it's going to slow down research, it's going to research points and production points, and I know that that Phil commented a couple times on this thread, so, and I have to agree with what he says.
Yeah, same. I mean, I'm not one to blend into a crowd being 6'1 with red hair, but I'm going to have to blend in with the crowd in this thread. The crowd is in defined by the number of people who replied to it and what they said. And really, it's, to me, if this is an advantage, let's just say for a moment that you can argue that it is an advantage, and I think that's even problematic. it's not a strong enough advantage to outweigh essentially not doing it. In other words, it's one step forward to what he's talking about and two steps backward at best.
Yeah, there's something to be said for getting being first to Alphabet and brokering techs and having some control over the early game trades. But in multiplayer, tech trades shouldn't even be on. And in single player, you do run into problems with the trade tech cap. We fear you're becoming too advanced, where AIs who aren't friendly will stop trading with you because of the number of trades you've already made. So if you're trading for lots of little technologies in the early game, that's risky. Then you also have to factor in the problems of, you know, maybe there's only one or two AI and they won't trade everything with you, so you'll be stuck without critical techs even after reaching Alphabet. And then just skipping worker techs is always a question mark. Because say you have a pig resource in your capital, you know, just on the flat ground, so six food, or six yield, no matter where it is, really. And you're not working that for 30, 40 turns because you're going for Alphabet before you're going for animal husbandry. Well, you know, now you're talking about well over 100 food that you could have had that you're probably not getting. And that's really huge. You know, that matters a lot. And a lot of the advantage that you would get from reaching Alphabet sooner is lost because you haven't developed your cities. And the more tile improvements you're missing, the further behind you are in worker turns, the slower your empire is going to have outputs. This is why I'm always on some of my fellow players to get more workers when I see their empire in the multiplayer games, just because the benefit of an improved tile over an unimproved tile is so great. And this really cuts down on the ability to get tile improvements. Now, I mentioned the worker steal because Marigold Rand has advocated the worker steal in other threads. And if you can pull that off, that's great. But even then, you want worker techs at least before Alphabet. Now, what a lot of advanced players will do is they'll run their slider at 0% after reaching writing and build some libraries and build whatever. And then at that point, if the Alphabet technology hasn't been researched yet, they'll max out on the slider at a deficit in an attempt to be the first Alphabet. But if Alphabet's researched, they can then research aesthetics, for example, and trade for Alphabet. And there's a quirk with the AI where it always trades Alphabet if it's willing to trade it at all, even though it wouldn't normally trade other monopoly techs. So you can get Alphabet pretty easily, regardless, either by researching it yourself or by researching something else like aesthetics and trading for it. That the benefit of going straight there at the expense of hurting your civilization all around is just not warranted. Plus, you don't need a bunch of warriors early in the game for the most part. I mean, yeah, you can spawn bust with them or whatever, but you can do that when you build tile improvements too.
Yeah, I'm going to join with the rest of you guys and say that I'm not really a fan of this strategy. I mean, what? I don't know. It's not something that I've ever even heard of before, but and intuitively, it just doesn't even sound like it makes a whole lot of sense. You can also say that, you know, when you have your first worker out, you can still have some worker techs, you know, already there, depending on what your starting techs are. If your civilization that starts with, you know, agriculture, for example, then it's really in your best interest to get a worker out, worker out immediately. Plus, I mean, I don't know if he really is thinking about the effects of working, you know, unimproved tiles, because it's really terrible. Like, you know, especially earlier in the game where you're just, I don't know, you're losing a lot of, you know, food and hammers that you could have just by improving your tiles. And,
How much faster do you think you're going to get settlers too? You're looking at, say, a corn tile and four mines versus unimproved tiles. I'm not convinced that on your third and fourth cities, you're actually getting your settlers faster.
No, I don't really think so either. I mean, I don't know. I hate the thought of working on improved tiles. Like, ugh. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, in trying to even understand where he was coming from with this suggestion, I think it's maybe embedded a little bit in his opening post. Where he talks about, it's a very simple strategy. Most Civ 1 or Civ 2 veterans will immediately understand what I'm going for.
No, I don't.
I was about to say, as a Civ 1 or a Civ 2 veteran, no, I don't. At the same time, I was thinking, if you were to do this, if you were to try this approach in Civ 1 or Civ 2, I don't think it would be as much of a negative. but it would still be a negative. I would not see the advantage of doing taking this approach in any Civ game to date, before or after Civilization IV. There also seems to be, through the discussion, some suggestion that it is possible for this to work up to and including Emperor level, and someone who only plays up to and including Emperor level, I'm not even sure, I am sure I'm not going to agree that it is going, I say is going to work. I mean, there's could, but you know, like we talked about the combat odds where 99.9% is, there's a chance, there's always a chance that, you know, you're going to get the screw job. You're going to get that 0.1% and you're going to say, darn. Well, to me, it's like, sure, this could work. But what's the percentage that this is likely going to work? And then if it does work, how well does it really work as compared to your other choices? So again, although I think I'm starting to understand a little more where he's coming from, and I do, you know, commend him trying to think, you know, outside of the box. And, you know, I can actually see this being fun. And if you go into the sense of, I'm going to try to handicap myself, maybe this is the alphabet handicap. Maybe that's what this thread should have been called.
There you go.
This was meant to be something that was going to help you, not like something that was going to, you know what I'm saying? Like, that was not his point. His point was like, oh yeah, this is actually a good thing you should do if you're trying to win. All right.
Yeah, but as it turns out, it's actually cherry tapping. So that does smile.
This thread wasn't started on April 1st, was it? Is that what's actually
no.
Oh. No.
It was later April.
Okay, good.
April 28th. You missed it by 27 days. Darn.
Yeah, it's a little late.
I mean, okay, and other people in the thread brought up some really good points. Number one, okay, what if you're isolated? That's just stupid. You know, come on.
You would know before you'd have to commit to alphabet, though. You would know.
I don't know. I mean, you could have already been on the way to pottery at that point without any, like, you know, without a lot of cottonful land, and then you got a useless tech. I mean, the risk is just too great.
Well,
I mean,
if he's doing a warrior spam, he could have sent them all out to scout. He would have found something. I mean, if we're going to argue for that.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's a specialized strategy at best.
Actually, that's true. Because he's opening warrior first, if he turns out to be isolated, he's already behind because of that. Guaranteed.
Right.
He's not going to get a worker, and he's not going to get tile improvement. So yeah, actually isolation would hurt.
And he's not going to be able to trade techs, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, if he did get a settler out, you know, before he did alphabet, which, I mean, he probably should. I mean, unless you're creative, you know, there's no way you're going to get a full fat cross, and you're just handicapping yourself further with two mediocre cities. Sorry, I just don't like the thought of this.
At least get the trade routes. If you have Coast Bridge, or if you have a river, or maybe you have the wheel, who knows, and you hook up the city, still at least, actually a second city will contribute to your research instead of hurt it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
As long as you don't settle it too far.
Even if you have the wheel, he's not building workers, so what's the point? I mean, you have to have either a wheel or a river. He
doesn't have tile improvements.
I mean, you're not even building your settlers.
It's hard for me to grasp how awful this is. I apologize.
I mean, you have to get this, unless you get it already. Like, whatever.
Well, it's really high risk with very low possibility of helping you, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yes. And I like what Dan said, that maybe it's a fun trick if you want to change up your gameplay once in a while. You know, you want to try something different or give yourself a handicap. But for every game, ooh, I think you're missing out on too much.
You want to handicap yourself? Just go up a few levels.
That's right.
Yeah, I want to continue playing on the difficulty level I've always played with, but I want to simulate being on a more on a higher difficulty level, so therefore I will try this. Well?
There's actually an option for that in the new, like, Beyond the Game, you know, mod that we mentioned earlier in this podcast. Like, I'm not kidding.
Yeah, you get monarch penalties, but the AI gets noble bonuses, which is still really easy. But it's an option there, yes.
Oh my gosh, Lisa, you brought continuity to our discussion by tying it into an earlier topic. Are you allowed to do that? Gee.
I won't do it again.
We try to avoid those things, actually. You didn't, obviously.
Is that Dan, you're threatened because she's becoming a better host than you?
It sounds like she's trying to chill under a little bit. But instead of making a really, really awkward transition, it was actually, like, working.
No, awkward was my role, remember?
Yeah,
right, sorry.
Fatality Slim in this thread actually said, the most interesting thing about this thread is how long serious players are going to debate this quote-unquote latest masterpiece, so it took 2 days and 5 pages, and on Polycast, it took us 13 minutes. So one episode in 13 minutes. There you go.
This service started by Malindor, and he's proposing a new victory called the Commercial Victory. It would require 2 more national wonders, one with banks and another with stock exchanges, saying possibly a national bank gives gold 1% of your treasure, Wall Street, etc. Then secondly, it would require the World Bank Wonder, which is plus 10 gold and triggers the Commercial Victory. And it would need electronics or computers. Then the third requirement would be, with the World Bank constructed, all the civilizations could make deposits on it. And then if you stay 10 turns with the greatest deposit, you would win. Then he says, one of the greatest effects of commercial social policies could be exchanged in order of helps that kind, I don't know what he's saying, in order of helps that kind of victory. Anyway, I just lost that. Giving you money for cash gold.
English.
Anyway, sorry about that. I just couldn't translate that to speaking out loud. But he's got some moderate support here. Most people think this is a good trade for the diplomatic victory. However, he's very adamant in his post that this would be in addition to that, a sort of an offsetting the diplomatic victory. And I guess he just wants to prove that you could win a commercial victory with a diplomatic. My personal hang up with this is that I don't get this World Bank deposits thing. It seems irrelevant and sort of pointless. And I don't think that having like 10 turns with the greatest deposit would be something that would allow you to win. It just sounds odd and sort of like it doesn't fit right to me. I don't know. But that's
basically telling the world, hey, I can make more money than you, and I'm going to prove it. And if you can keep up with your gold for 10 turns and other people can't, you're going to win. And yes, that does instantly make you think of diplomatic victory, because essentially the city-states function as a bidding war. So if you were to put something like this in, you can't really have the city-state thing in as well in its current form. You'd have to change how diplomatic victories work, which would probably be a good thing, mind you. But certainly right now, diplomatic and quote-unquote commercial are way too close.
You know what I think? What would be really interesting with this World Bank, not, you know, you having the most gold to put in it, but what if you can convince other civs to put their money in your bank? You know, you get so much money from somebody else in there, you know, then you win. That seems appropriate to me. But I don't know.
You're going to reap the AI of gold even more than it already is.
Why not? Besides, it pulls in this interesting thing of strategy plus persuasion. You know, like, if you're really going for a commercial victory, you've got to start, like, you know, getting the AIs to really love you early on. So they're like, oh, yeah, gold, here you go. We'll put it in your bank. We trust you to keep it safe for us, right?
Okay, if we're playing multiplayer game, I ask you to put money in my World Bank. Will you give me, do you have any incentive to give me money? Then,
totally
come
not.
On, we can't really have a feature like this. That's just silly.
Well, no, it's not.
I want to see something where everyone actually can play the game and try to win, not just, oh, the opponent is stupid, so we can win.
No, it seems like an interesting AI thing. Maybe it wouldn't translate well to multiplayer, but I don't play multiplayer very often, so...
You know, when I saw this, I thought about actually Civilization Revolution, because Civilization Revolution doesn't have a diplomatic victory, but it has an economic victory, where you have to build the World Bank, and you can only build the World Bank after you've accumulated 20,000 gold.
Oh, that's right.
And I couldn't then instantly help but think about Civilization V and how much the AI likes to hoard gold, and I thought, hey, here's a way that the AI...
That would be similar to the economic victory from Alpha Centauri. You had to have a certain amount of credits that was a certain percentage of the entire credit in the system, so to speak. So an AI could probably easily pull that off. And then there's a separate thing, and you don't have to rely on other players depositing.
People complain so much, it would be great. AI has won an economic victory.
Yeah.
Well, you would have to have something further down the tech tree, like economics or banking or something way down there to even make that possible, so you didn't have that happen in the first 10 turns or something like that.
Oh, you'd have to go way down beyond economics and banking. I mean, you'd probably want to put that in a similar area as the UN, because otherwise it would just be ridiculous. Even the humans would just win that way. It's like, here, you want a resource for gold, which I won't spend? Here, you want a resource for gold? Hey, you want to trade some resource for gold? I declare war on you. Hey, you want to trade again? Then all of a sudden the human has 20,000 gold.
Yeah, it needs a little tweaking, but you could make it work a little bit better than the commercial victory one.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like a commercial victory, it's kind of like, you know, the money that you are making in a turn, the money that you have banked. I mean, isn't a lot of the other victory conditions you have anyway kind of a commercial victory as well, like indirectly? Like in terms of you were able to get this much gold a turn, you're able to bank this much gold, which you then turn into upgrading something or rushing something. And so then that could help for domination or conquest, or that could help towards the space race or even a cultural victory and things like that. Like how could you even make this, you know, be distinguished from...
Well, it's already distinguished. It's called Screw You Guys. I'm going to sit on my pile of gold like I'm Scrooge McDuck.
And yes, basically gold can equal research in this game because you just ban research agreements and they're really powerful.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Thank you, Mackie. I knew Mackie would support me. Okay.
What?
Oh, that bell. Surely for that.
You know what? I was about to say my ability to turn an awkward moment even to something more awkward was pretty impressive, but Phil just, he took that away from me. Thanks, Phil.
Well, that's pretty much my dedicated role, I thought. I thought that's what it said in my contract. You know, QNL gives e-kisses, and I just make things more awkward. It says it right there. In the letter. I don't know what to say.
Wow, you guys are just such a great cast. I just...
It's my role.
We're Polycast.
Oh, wait, whoa. Annalie just like trolled us. You guys are a great cast, not. At least Annalie thought she could say that and nobody wouldn't pick up on it. We don't just, you know, not object, so that means...
I thought it was the guest's job to make fun of everybody else. Is that right? I thought that was right.
The guest's job, you know, you're all idiots. What are you doing?
I also like how to point out Lisa did not object to Phil... actually essentially saying that, in fact, in Lisa's contract is virtual kisses. She did not object.
No, I said e-kisses, not virtual kisses.
I don't understand why I can't be the one to make things awkward. Why is it Phil that gets to do that, huh?
Because I do it.
I mean, people don't want Phil's e-kisses?
Cornered the market, Lisa.
We can grant your request right now. Say something, Lisa, and none of us will say anything for a few seconds, so therefore it's awkward. Go ahead.
But I can do that without saying anything. I can just, like, see, it works.
Hi.
Awkward. Thanks, Lisa. Jeez.
Thank you to listen. Thank you for listening to this Polycast episode number, insert number now, Dan.
At 132.
Yes, 132. That's what I was thinking. And we've had with us today Dan Q.
I need more caffeine to deal with you people.
Mackie.
Oh, dude. Am I on? What?
QNL or Lisa.
I'll show you too much on my hands right now.
And the me and team Phil.
Always allowing alliterations, eh? Join us next time where I present a top 5 poll for civilization alliterations.
And I'm Carter Bandoa and Annalie. Thanks for listening.
story date October 15th, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.